Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
To another Word in Your Ear, where we're talking about a fascinating and extremely original book, Excavate the Wonderful and Frightening World of the Fall, which is perfectly described in a review I saw as a book of revelations. And these are the two people who've compiled it. Welcome aboard, Tessa Norton and Bob Stanley. Lovely to see you.
Hi. Good evening.
And you have your son, I think, Len, crawling around in his pyjamas at your feet. Yeah. Is that right? He might make an appearance at some stage. I hope so.
You might get a cameo from our erratic front man.
Excellent.
He's up in his bedroom at the moment with the promise of a bribe. So.
Yeah, oh, right. Okay, good.
Well, look, I should warn you that Dave and I are kind of both entry-level Fall appreciators, so we need educating, but we absolutely love this book, and it's a really, really unusual format. So explain first of all the component parts of this book. It's really unusual.
We got the idea. We were talking about the fall after Marky Smith, shortly after he died, and we've got like a shelf of books on the fall. And some of them are better than others, but none of them are really what the fall meant to us, I suppose. So we were thinking about how would you do the ultimate book on the fall. We thought the way to do it is not to write about the fall at all, but to write about their world or their subject matter, Mark Smith's subject matter. And if it's written by people who are, you know, more than familiar with the fall's work already, then of course the book will be about the fall. So it's really writing around the subject.
It's a series of essays, isn't it? Some written by you two and some, I presume, commissioned especially for it by you. And also there's lyrics and ephemera. And
including us, and then plus a select few reprints, which I think the probably the best known is the Mark Fisher one, Memorex for the Kraken, but which is obviously wonderful. Already. And some others which hadn't had a hugely wide audience, maybe they'd been published in sort of art press or in academic contexts and stuff like that. But yeah, our idea was that it would be a wide-ranging essay collection that covered a lot of ground. And our sort of starting premise was that you can't really look directly at the sun. So, and the fall was like that as well. You know, you needed, in order to kind of, you know, interpret or kind of illuminate that world, you would have to kind of talk about like the everything else, you know, everything that was kind of like left.
So give us some idea of some of the themes and some of the opinions that the book advances that you thought were particularly good and interesting and revealing.
Well, we wanted to get a collection of good writers with their own kind of areas of interest and expertise and to allow them to sort of play to their own strengths. So good example of that, the first one in the book is an essay about architecture in Manchester in the Northwest by Elaine Harwood, who's a very eminent architecture writer and writes books, works for Historic England, and she's also just happens to be a massive Fall fan. So she seemed the perfect person to kind of write something that was a sort of synthesis of those.
Yeah, I think she's seen the Fall more than anybody I've ever met.
Really?
I know she has.
So are they the kind? It's quite interesting. This. So are they the kind of group that if you find, I say kind of group, they're probably no doubt unique, but if you find Fall fans who are kind of eminent chemists or I don't know architects or whatever, they can always tell you how the Fall illuminates their particular area. Is that the kind of thing that tends to happen?
I haven't tried it with every single discipline, but I would like to.
And right.
Would be good. I bet there's something you could do. The interesting thing about Fall fans is they're found in all walks of life. You know, the fans that we met have quite interesting and varied jobs. You know, not always. It's not always obvious. There are also lots of kind of Fall super fans hiding in public life.
Jeremy Vine.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting. When Mark died, it was just interesting how many people came out of the woodwork, didn't they, with these major intellectuals and Guardian writers and, you know, just all saying, almost competitively actually saying, this group means so much to me. I was really touched by it, actually. Jeremy Vine, that's fascinating.
I think it's, being in a band, it may seem quite odd that the Fall of Influence and Etienne, but they really have, you know, we never did encores when we started. The sort of typography, the press releases, which I had a few of just by writing to them when I was a teenager. We borrowed a lot from that, and it's it won't be obvious. And I remember like reading interview with Aztec Camera with Roddy Frame, and he said Aztec Camera, his favourite group is The Fall, but you'd never know that from listening to them. I think they can be, that's where they're pretty different to almost any other group I can think of, where they could be a major influence without their music really impacting on your music at all. Not obviously.
Well, that's a really good point, because it's about kind of theory and attitude, isn't it? And technique and application and just the way they made their art. As you say, you don't have to sound like them at all, but it's the way they operate. It was very influential, wasn't it?
Part of that, and also like a way of looking at the world as well. Mm. Like, you know, such kind of wide-ranging reference points, you know. Still kind of like, as you know, you go through life, you can be doing something quite random, you know, watching an old film or driving through a town, or you know, you just see a bit of signage or hear a bit of dialogue or read something in a book, and it will just kind of spark like what's like quite a buried Fall reference that probably seeped in there when you were 14 listening to Jump In Your Bedroom. So there's this kind of whole worldview that's kind of buried in like fans' heads, and that's kind of what we wanted to
try to do. So it's not like in any standard kind of music book. It's not the band's career. It's not track by track. It's not this is the best LP or anything like that. It's more how they looked, looking through their eyes, I suppose, or Mark E. Smith's eyes, at the things that interested him. Isn't that fair enough?
Yeah, I think it's more than.
We said that we wrote an introduction, but it's kind of written for him because it's a lot of subject matter that would have interested him. I mean, he might have just thrown it in the bin.
Yeah, I was going to say
almost certainly.
And they got it out again after you'd gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's one chapter I thought was very related, the one that you've written, Bob, about the way they operated again. It's about amateurism. It makes such a good point that, you know, amateurism was a glorious thing. You know, amatore, you know, people did things for love and not for money. And now it's become a term of kind of abuse, implying slapdash and inept. And I thought that was a really interesting point, that they were never professionals, you know, that they never signed to a big label. They were never on that kind of album tour cycle that could go off and you could make, you know, could collaborate with the dancer Michael Clark. And it gave them incredible freedom. But now there isn't any of that around, as far as I can see. You know, that's not a kind of modern value. It's all very commercial. Would that be right?
I'm sure there are people who still have that ethic. I mean, again, that's something we definitely borrowed from them, which is why we never did more of America to try and break America. It wasn't really very us. I think it's true. I think the other side of the coin is that he had a really strong work ethic, obviously, or the group had.
Incredibly.
So it was like a, you know, non-professional but with a strong work ethic. So very productive, did almost an album a year, not quite, sort of tailed off towards the end. But absolutely, it gave them complete freedom to do what they wanted. And it's, you know, they did sign to a major for a while just to see what happened. And I don't think they got on top of the pops, but, you know, they got in the top 40. They got into the smash hit sticker book.
There you go.
They did, I know.
Yeah,
do you think he achieved what he wanted? I mean, was he resentful about the fact that they hadn't sold more? Did he achieve what he wanted to achieve, do you think?
I certainly don't think he was greedy. I don't think he ever had any money. I think all the money he ever made went into the group and keeping the group going. So, who knows? As far as I know, he was quite happy keeping the group going, and that's what he wanted to do. So yeah,
there's a lovely point that you made about the fact that they refused to play TV shows who made them write down their lyrics, because obviously TV programs need the lyrics written down for camera angles for the director, you know. And he said that as long as they weren't set in stone, the songs were still alive. So is that how he regarded it? It's a bit like Bob Dylan records and clearly feels that the way that song was on the day it was taped is just one version of a song that's eternally evolving. Was that how he regarded his songs, do you think?
I'd guess so. I mean, again, I wouldn't want to second guess what he thought, but if they would like drop songs for years and then bring them back, and you know, in quite a different form, and certainly, yeah, the lyrics changed. There's some really good, very thorough websites about full lyrics and different and gigs where they do different versions and you change the words, and it's all very well annotated online. But yeah, again, that's something else we borrowed from them. We never, St. Etienne have never printed lyrics for the same reason, really. It's like, I always think it's better if you hear a lyric in your head, it's always almost always going to be better than the actual lyric if you've got it wrong.
Yeah.
But I think now, the first time I heard Spectre versus Rex by the Fall, I thought it was about Elmore James rather than M.R. James. I had no idea that M.R. James
right.
was.
Right. Fair point.
Yeah, it is.
It's, I tell you, one of the things that strikes me going through it, it's obviously, you know, it's got a kind of scrapbooky quality to it, hasn't it? You know, you've got a huge amount of printed paper material in here. And it really brought home to me again just how important ink and paper was to what all sorts of groups did in that era. And when somebody sets out to write anything comparable about bands right now, there won't be that, will there? You know, so you kept all these scraps, or you found all these scraps. Tell us about that and how this stuff came together and how important it is.
Well, we wanted very much the visual materials to be, yeah, like you say, the paper and the, you know, the nature of each thing that is photographed or scanned in there as an object, so you can see crumples and bits of foxing and stuff like that, because we wanted everything that we put in there to be something that people had treasured. So, you know, it's not a photograph of a mint condition album, because that would just look like, you know, it looked when it came out of the factory.
Yeah,
we wanted the stuff that kind of people had, you know, pinned to their bedroom wall, or that they'd kind of come with them in a shoebox through various house moves and stuff like that. And we wanted to be quite true to kind of like what the fans had valued. So there's, you know, one of my favorite things in there is a beer mat that's been sort of scribbled on, and someone's kind of like taken that home. Yes, as you would.
Absolutely.
I had a carrier bag of Mark E. Smith's when I was a teenager that was just like the most boring plain white carrier bag that he'd had shoved in his pocket at a gig, and you know, I mostly pick it up at the end.
So you got sorry, this is a gig. You went to a gig when you were a teenager. Tell us about that. Go on.
Well, and he'd had this like plain white carrier bag, which I can describe. You know, the kind of one that's got the kind of dome top with the circular handle that you get from.
Oh, right, okay.
Off-license carrier bag.
And that just it fell onto the floor at the end of the gig when I picked it up. So I kept this, like, with the original crumple.
Blame.
Like, pinned to my notice board for ages. And then one day it must have just fallen off and I just put stuff in it and I forgot. And then, like,
God.
I had it for about 3 years. But anyway, that kind of level of object may be a bit more interesting than that.
There's a wonderful thing printed called the Sinister Times, which is a kind of mock 1950s newspapers, and it came out, I think, in 1987 or something. It's effectively just the lyrics that just beautifully reproduced. I thought that was so fantastic, the amount of effort. There's press releases in there, which I can only assume were written by him. Were they written by him? Because so much kind of fall folklore. And it's all about each member of the new member of the band and what they're like. And it's so characterful. It made me think of groups like the Smiths and the Beatles, where absolutely everything they did that became public was clearly thought about as part of some huge artistic statement, really. Everything was really scrutinized.
Yeah,
very impressive.
Definitely. I think it's, they're the people I look up to the most, I suppose, really, people who've made that much. Spend that much attention on artwork and sleeve notes and whatever. how the spine looks compared to the other records.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I think hopefully comes across in the book is his sense of humour, because it's easy for him to be characterised as this curmudgeonly bloke, beer and fags character. And he was, you know, there was a lot of warmth to the letters he wrote to people, which are in the book. And
yeah, they're beautiful.
It must have been huge, because lots of people we got in touch with had a collection of Christmas cards from him. Very funny.
Mm. Oh, right.
So not kind of barbed and sarcastic then, but...
No, just maybe like some gentle ribbing or something, pointing to an elf and going, look, that's you, you know, that kind of thing. But, just really like old school politeness and warmth. And I think we did feel that his reputation was being done a disservice by just reducing it to this sort of caricature of, like, you know, irascible front man, national treasure, reading the football results, which is obviously part of it. And, you know, there's a degree to which, you know, he probably enjoyed slipping into a persona, you know, to, I think I used the Columbo analogy the other day, which I'm not completely...
Serge Gainsbourg, I think, as well. The creating a character and then becoming the character.
Right.
I'm sure that's true, actually.
Mike and I were just talking about it this morning, and I said, well, I met him once, and he called me Whistle Test all the way through the conversation. And Mark said, that's funny. I met him once, and he also called me Whistle Test all the way.
He called me Whistle Test. First of all, he called me Yorkshire Weatherman. And I don't know who he thought I was, but he'd obviously seen me on the television and he couldn't think where it was on the television. Yorkshire Weatherman. You know, it was so funny. It was Select magazine had this event. It was about 1991. You know, it was one of those kind of round table things. Very, very, very fashionable at the time. Andrew Harrison was chairing this event. And it was Mark E. Smith. It was Peter Hooton of The Farm and Mickey Berenier, I think it was, of Lush. And they were addressing the great issues of the day and putting the world to rights. And all I can remember about Mark was that he smoked nonstop. He was there for about, I think, 4.5 hours. And in those 4.5 hours, I think he drank 11 pints and 11 whiskey chasers and didn't appear to be remotely pissed. He appeared to be very kind of focused and incredibly funny and scathing. And I thought, this is astonishing. but you're right. There was a kind of curmudgeon kind of persona built up by the press that he was clearly occupying, I think. There must have been other dimensions to his character that you never got to see.
Yeah, especially kind of like from the sort of like mid-late 90s onwards. But, you know, there's a lot else to it as well. Like, obviously, it's, you know, it's all the things people say, but it's, you know, we also, it's why we wanted the subject matter to be kind of as wide-ranging in the essays. It's about, you know, football and factory foremen and ghost stories and, you know, Manchester itself, and it's not any one thing, but it's everything.
It's a long time since I read a book that had quite so much about working men's clubs in it.
Yeah.
Go on, tell us about that. Why was that an important thing?
well, I think that was probably connected to his work ethic thing. Again, if you read interviews with him, it sounds like they play working men's clubs all the time. And I think Paul Wilson, who's a lecturer at Leeds, has written an essay in there on typography. And he went through every gig they ever did and found out how many social clubs or working men's clubs they played. And I think it was about 8 in total.
Well, he certainly built that up, didn't he? Because he talked about that as being where he learnt his craft, didn't he?
Yeah,
and people would be throwing real glasses at him and audience members spitting at him and stuff.
Yeah.
But fans today don't know they're born. It's all that, isn't it?
Yeah. But I love that, you know, so it's like, you know, that's as much as sort of building up your own mythology as, you know, Elvis did or whatever. It's like, it's a very pop move. He knew exactly what he was doing. One of my favourite stories in there is where they left Rough Trade in 81, I think, after Slates, and signed to a label called Camera with a K, which I'd never heard of. I don't think anybody else had ever heard of at the time. It seemed like quite a strange move, but they put out Hex Induction Hour, and he's interviewed by the Quietists in there, and he's saying, we started the Camera because they're a heavy metal label, and I really wanted to get that, you know, that kind of heavy metal vinyl you get. It's really sort of grainy quality, the kind of thing they press Sabbath's greatest hits on, you know what I mean? And the poor interviewer's going, yeah. It's like,
yes.
What is that? That doesn't exist.
Yes, absolutely.
You read it back and you're like, hang on a minute. That's
He's done that to everybody, you know.
But it's kind of a strangely romantic view of the world, isn't it? Yeah, I'd like it to be like this, you know. I'd like to make a something that felt like my idea of a heavy metal record, even if my idea is wrong.
If it's not literally true, isn't it? You know, that's kind of, you know, there's a sort of, it's a fidelity to something, even if it's not literally.
Tell me about the world of Fall fans, because I would imagine if you can write a book as dense and as this, you know, about a subject like the Fall, you're not the only ones out there. Presumably there are people who are world experts on the Fall. Do you fear those kind of people going, I think you'll find you've got so-and-so wrong on page 32? Have you dealt with any of that?
I think we wanted to take a different approach, partly because there's some really brilliant websites created by the fans, which are like so thorough and collate set lists and dates that things happened and really like map that process by which, you know, sets evolve and songs change and lineups change and stuff like that. You know, all that stuff's out there, and we didn't want to kind of like to reprint or like repeat.
No, we've got a timeline to give it a thread.
Some structure, but
also, I mean, a lot of those people we did obviously get in touch with because they've got a lot of the material in the book was borrowed from them.
Right.
And they were all, absolutely all of them were lovely. They're really nice. Nobody was like, oh, hold on a minute, I was going to do a book like that. No one said anything.
I'm surprised. I was really interested reading. There's a lot about football in the book, and it made me feel that, in a sense, they, I don't know if they're as much as fans as supporters. The football analogy seemed really appropriate to me. It's a bit like Happy Mondays. You know, the people who went to see them were going to see them as if going to an away fixture, and the Fall could clearly play the same set two consecutive nights, and maybe one of those nights they'd be absolutely brilliant and one they'd be terrible. So there was a kind of result at the end of the evening. Do you know what I mean? There was a score line. And people seemed to sort of feel that they were part of the rhythm of life somehow, seeing the group. Did you think that's true, that that kind of loyalty of the fans was like a kind of, we support them for better or worse, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good analogy. And, you know, you're absolutely right about how good they might have been on certain nights. I think Adele Stripe, who wrote one of the essays, says she saw them and it was the worst gig she'd ever seen in her life. And then she didn't go and see them for about another 15 years because she was really scared to go and see them again. But in the years in between, she just found them fascinating and got into them anyway. But that's a pretty amazing starting point, the worst gig you've ever seen.
It really is.
Same way,
it is.
Generally, they're not uncritical. You know, there's a sort of the way I see it, and I wouldn't want to kind of presume how everyone else feels, but it's like there's, once you're invested in it, you know, you have to kind of care when it's bad if it matters to you about when it's good. So that's a really like important thing. But also, maybe this feels a little bit contradictory, but hopefully not. At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter whether you had a good time at any particular gig, because the whole project and the way it kind of itself is sort of the point. The fans are great. We met some really lovely people, and obviously they've kept brilliant things, and we're quite on board with kind of what we thought was interesting as well.
And he seems very like a football manager, too. The way that there's, I can't remember how many members of the Fall there have been, there's over 60 now. He's constantly changing the lineups. And so you look back at periods of the Fall like you look back at moments in a history, in a football club's history, with a particular lineup, don't you? And he was always scouring the lower league groups, wasn't he, for new members. And I think that's just an interesting, totally different way of doing things, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of new members just came from other bands in, not just in Manchester, but in like, sort of the Prestwich area.
I was going to say, because he combed the local area.
Yeah.
So he must have been, if you were a musician in that area, you must have one time or another had the rule run over you by Mikey Smith.
Yeah.
And either joined the group or, sorry, not, you're not right. Seriously, mustn't that have happened?
Yeah. I'd have thought so. Yeah.
Yeah, and you do wonder how many undocumented members there are out there.
Absolutely.
People who don't talk about it. They did one gig or something.
Was Mark Riley really sacked on his wedding day?
Oh.
Well, that's, that's one claim that he has. I've lost track of who said what, but I will tell you this, that not all the stories add up. And what might seem quite strange about the book, but we definitely felt was the fairest way, is that we didn't significantly involve any, or didn't really involve any ex-members, because we just felt it was, what we wanted to do was kind of capture kind of what they meant to the fans. And there are so many stories to tell. There are so many ex-members. They all deserve their own space.
Well, absolutely. Well, surely once you've asked one, you've got to ask the other 59 or whatever.
You did the right thing. You did the right thing.
A completely different kind of book. And it wouldn't be anywhere, nowhere near as uplifting and energising as the book you put out.
There's only so many pages that you can, like, cram into the
hard book.
So what bit of the book are you personally most, you know, pleased with, proud of, would like to draw people's attention to, think it turned out well, whatever? Anything in particular?
Cool, that's another thing.
Oh, lots.
A lot of his things he's written.
The early press releases and stuff, I think, are amazing.
Right,
they're wonderful.
We tried to kind of reproduce them as kind of close to original size as possible. The book's obviously a bit smaller than A4, but they're worth kind of poring over and really immersing yourself in that voice. That stuff's just priceless. And
some of the lyrics,
the notes for lyrics, notes they're probably lyrics. Not the final or anything like that. But
Ian Penman interviewed him in, I think, 79, and Mark Smith gave him just some typewritten lyrics, which weren't the ones that came out. It's like an early version of Psychic Dancehall. And he kept them all this time and lent them to us, which was fantastic. But I think he typed out the lyrics for the other band members. So we got some others via Yvonne Paulet, who was in the group for about a year when she was 16 in 1978, 1979.
A friend of mine was working in a record shop and her daughter came in to do record work experience, so he'd had some copies of duplicated.
Well, she came into work one day. That's a good story.
So this girl came in, and my friend had a full badge on, and this girl just went, "My mum was in them." And she's like, "What?
My mum was in them."
And then they got talking.
That's a good line. That is my mum.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, it's such a nice kind of passing of generations thing. I guess statistically there's quite a lot of kids walking.
My mum was in the fall. That's a
that's absolutely brilliant. Just going back to the lyrics, I was just, all those songs about those characters, Joe Total and Wireless Enthusiast and Fiery Jack and the man whose head expanded. And then so he invents all those characters. Then there's songs about his own life, working in the docks at one point. There's songs about, observations, killer conspiracy, about posh people liking football. There's one amazing song about a rebellious jukebox. It's written from the point of view of the jukebox itself, really. And it made me think, are there any other lyricists who write in such a wide variety of idioms? I couldn't really think of anybody. Can you think of anyone who you could compare with him in principle?
Been asked if there's anybody else who could do a book like this about, and I was thinking Bob Dylan was one of the few people I could think of.
Yeah.
And similarly, of that kind of push pull of him being resistant to, interpretation or using bits of misdirection. Obviously, a very different artist, but I don't think it's a stretch to say it's kind of comparable in scope. But I could imagine good books of this nature on anyone who's where the kind of the meaning of their work is a little bit detached from the public understanding. But only the fool would have a book with all this stuff in, because
the only other group I was thinking about And clearly you wouldn't have anything about football or Northern Working Men's Clubs in it, is The Grateful Dead. You either buy the whole idea of The Grateful Dead or you don't buy it at all. You don't get on board for one little bit of it. You know what I mean? And people who go see The Grateful Dead, well, back in the day, they said some gigs were terrible, some gigs were brilliant. Didn't make any difference. It was an unfolding story, wasn't it? It was just... It was a thing that was going on all the time. But that leads me to the question, do they have fans in America? And how do they respond to the very specific Northern Manchester, you know, lens on everything?
They do, but all the ones I know are quite Anglophile. So
really?
Understand it.
Yeah. I mean,
I guess there's levels of nuance that, of course. And there's an essay in the book that Dan Fox wrote about, he's an English guy, now lives in New York, so it's been an interesting sort of take on it, is about the Fall and their relationship to America and like how that's, you know, he like maybe kind of surprisingly pro-American and kind of enjoyed going over there and obviously, you know, married an American wife and that was something that interested him at least for a time. But yeah, you're right. It is very specifically Northern.
Your little boy just appeared back.
Len just appeared. Did you see him there? His head appeared between the two of you. That is wonderful.
He just had a look. He wants his bribe. You know, you're bribing
a point to make, probably. He's thinking, I've heard all this before. My parents are quacking on about the Fall again.
That maybe just got a notch smaller.
Oh, I just wanted to mention the extraordinary details. There's lots of really interesting stuff about where the musical influences come from, which, you know, Beefheart and Zappa and Peter Hamill and the Seeds and the Stooges. And at one point, I can't remember which chapter's in there, it mentioned Kenny Everett's World's Worst Record Show, which is an album that came out in about 78, I think. It consisted of just absolutely frightful, amateurish, kind of hopeless attempts at comedy
records.
Not so fast.
No, but they, of course, they were really, a lot of them were really, really influential, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's a mixture of stuff that is genuinely appalling, like Jessica records and the legendary Stardust Cowboy, who, as it turns out, apparently influenced Ziggy Stardust and Marquis Smith.
That's right.
And I'm Going to Spain by Steve Bent, which is...
Which he did a version of, didn't he?
Yeah. A terrific record. It's like
both versions, yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Doesn't like anything ever written.
Wasn't there a rumour or a theory once that the whole thing was an elaborate prank by Kenny Everett and Steve Bent didn't really exist? Which didn't turn out...
Yes, there was, that's true.
Steve Bent is real. But I also like that kind of parallel theory that it's some sort of psyop. And this, none of this stuff is really real.
But you actually, I don't know if you say this or somebody says this in the book, that the World's Worst Record Show, whatever it was called, was the most influential record in the Fall universe.
Fall's history. Yeah.
Which I really like.
I like that too.
But it's not Marquee Moon, is it? You
know? But I suppose it's like, yeah, they obviously the amateurism of most of the people on there is probably quite an influence. Sorry, the production values of Nervous Norvus. I mean, you probably know Transfusion by now.
Yeah, Transfusion. Yeah, yeah.
Know it all.
Which is a Waters film, I think. So I mean, it's it's kind of. There's. I can't think what else. Shifting Whispering Sands by Eamon Andrews.
Oh, Eamon.
Not a big influence on the Fall, but it's not the whole album, but certainly bits of it. And I think just the idea of it. This very strange kind of like other music, which
it's it's kind of outsider music, as it fashionably became called later on.
Yeah. I'm sure that that's what Bob Trimble would have ended up on there.
And also really crude and kind of one chord a lot of it, wasn't it? You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't it also? And I speak as a complete outsider on this. Isn't it also exemplify something that ran through the Fall, which was kind of anti-cool, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
It was kind of clanky and awkward and, you know, and celebrated those things. I mean, did the Fall ever care what they looked like?
I think he did, but it was never
too fashionable. You know, like we were saying earlier, it never got cozy, but never too fashionable. But you know, at the same time, it always has, you know, an aesthetic.
And, yes. You know, no, I agree there.
The way he would, like Mark would dress on stage was, you know, just quite like a normal guy. You know, it's just like it's slightly disarming, I suppose. You know, no one's sort of like playing at being a punk or whatever.
No.
He dressed like kind of, you know, almost to blend in, and then the content of your work is what's surprising in my book.
Has anything since you finished the book, and a book like this must take a hell of a lot of pulling together because you got the art as well as the words. Presumably, Sod's Law dictates that as soon as you finished it and send it off to the printer, you found something that somebody sent you something that, damn, you should have got that in. Has that not happened?
We had more stuff than we could use already.
All right, okay.
And also, I don't want to moan about lockdown too much, but obviously we were preparing it last year, and if it hadn't been for that, you know, who knows what more stuff we could have found. Mm. But you know, we had access to some like amazing collections already, mm. and I was sort of really happy with everything that we got. And that, you know, there were other things that, you know, if we'd been able to travel a little bit and, you know, talk to maybe more of the artists or something, I can also imagine it would have been really nice to make space for, you know, some of the artists that were involved in the sleeve artwork and some of the exhibitions. But as it was, we just didn't have space to do that justice. But
that's the only thing I think, you know, we would have liked to include that we didn't really, because the artists are in Germany or America or Cornwall, all of which were equally inaccessible, aren't
they? Yeah, I suppose so.
But as full admirers tend to be kind of completists, then the possibility of a second volume is surely not out of the question, really, is it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, someone was saying we should do it like a Beano annual.
there you go.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's a good idea.
And, you know, I can also imagine, you know, another 10 essay commissions that would be equally good. I quite like your chemistry idea. I want to hear.
Oh, there you go. I'll find you a chemist. Well, look, there it is. Excavate the Wonderful and Frightening World of the Fall. Available in bookshops, actually reopen next week. So you can actually go and support your local independent bookstore by buying this book. It's out now. Tessa and Bob, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And
really good to see you. Thoroughly recommended that book.
And now you're gonna go and bribe your boy. You've told him if he's quiet, he'll get some bribe. I can't imagine what it is.
Give him my debit card and the Lego website. I don't know.
the shape of modern parenting. Very nice to talk to you.
Great to see you.
Cheers.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.